Hello and welcome to the Gale Hill Radio Hour. I'm your host, Kate Jones, having a conversation with Anne Batchelor Hersey, poet, writer, and author of Field Notes to Maya Lin's Confluence Project Landscapes. So glad to have you on the show today, Anne.
Thanks.
We have a lot to talk about, so let's get started.
At only 64 pages long, your book, Field Notes, is a beautifully designed little paperback that gives readers big themes to ponder. Chief among them, I think, is what it means to call a place home. Is that right, Anne?
Well, home is such a big and inclusive word, and the Confluence Project looks at the bicentennial and the homelands that they took on the Columbia River and over some mountains on their way out to the Pacific coast. So I'm looking at the big words of home, hometown, and homelands. How does that sound? And homelands refers to the first people who lived out here before the settler culture moved out west. Thanks to Lewis and Clark. Core discovery.
Yes.
So there we go.
Yes. Though they didn't actually discover anything, did they?
Right.
They discovered people living there. So anyway, how did this project come about?
Wow. Okay. So money was beginning to flow into both Oregon and Washington State, getting ready for the bicentennial. And almost at the same time, the tribes along the river, the ones that are renowned for greeting Lewis and Clark and featured in their journals, they said, how about we celebrate the people who greeted Lewis and Clark on their way out here? And then there was a nonprofit, not yet named Confluence, but a wonderful free-thinking person who said, Maya Lin, I think we need Maya Lin for this. And at the same time, back at the Umatilla, his name, Anton Minthorn, said, Maya Lin, I think we need Maya Lin. It's documented that within 24 hours, both this organizer in Vancouver, Washington, and this tribal, I won't call him chief, but he was in charge of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla, they had the exact same idea. So they contacted Maya Lin, and at first she said no. And then she thought differently when a good representation of the tribes with Jane Jacobson, this nonprofit person, flew to New York City and greeted her, made an appointment and greeted her in her studio in Manhattan and said, this is what we want you to do. It's not going to be just about Lewis and Clark. It's going to be Lewis and Clark and how we help them on their journey. And then she said, oh, well, I will do it then. And so I think they traveled there in the 1999s or early aughts. And then the Confluence Project was formally put together in 2002. It's okay. A nonprofit out here.
And the
maybe that's more than you want to know.
No, that's good. It's good grounding. I like that. And the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial was in 2005.
Right. They traveled out here. They went one way and then they spent the winter out on the coast just north of Astoria in a really awful winter, which I guess it often is, wet. And then they turned around and went back and in the 06 and 1806. So it was a round trip deal for them. Huge, huge traveling. Anyway, but what we have with the Confluence Project are as soon as they hit the Snake River and then that flows into the Columbia River, that's where all these river tribes lived and greeted them along the way. And they helped choose the six spots for these Maya Lin landscapes and or art installations. They've been called both.
Right.
And she worked with the tribal elders and artists to come up with how they want visitors who come there to learn more about their people, the land, and their history.
Yes. So very, very cool. So, and you live in the Pacific Northwest, Mount Lake Terrace, Washington, and you've lived in the Seattle area for a long time.
We've been out here longer than we've been in Ohio, my husband and I. Yeah.
Yes. So how did a visit to Pike Place Market in Seattle draw you into the Confluence Project?
Oh, I love this story because, you know, I'm a poet as well as a former teacher. I've had a lot of hats in my life, but I love Pike Place Market, and I went there just to go there for fun and to be inspired. And when I looked down, they have these craftspeople that have, you know, things they want to sell, as well as fish and vegetables and flowers. So I met a petroglyph there on a necklace. And it would be okay if I share this poem I wrote. This was written way before I knew about field notes.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, and the poem is... people listening, just know that I'm going to be using words that are unfamiliar because they're names of tribes, and the petroglyph is called She Who Watches, but her wishram name is Shaglal, and I think that's all you need to know before I start reading this poem called How It All Began. Pike Place Market, 2014. When I first saw her face carved into a black resin charm for sale on a necklace in Pike Place Market, I spoke her English name, She Who Watches, and learned about coyotes' question to her long ago when animals could talk. Her village sheltered, well-fed, and happy. He said, changes are going to happen. How will you watch over your people? She did not know, so Old Man Coyote changed her into a silent face carved in rock to watch over her people through wind and rain below her cliff. Shaglal, last of the women chiefs, her large almond eyes watch her people high above Big River. Wishram, Wasco, Tenino, Umatilla, Yakima. She stares down winds that pulse against basaltic cliffs. She who watches knows spears and hooks and nets that harvest arching salmon. Her men catch salmon as women dry and trade this wealth with other tribes. I once believed those eyes could be any woman's eyes. Eyes that search for a child's return. Eyes that check out back to close a door to thunder. Eyes that guide a hand to crack a window open, allow the lull of rain to enter, to tuck a blanket under, to stoke a fire, to keep a family warm and dry. But I lied to you. This stone owl woman is not any woman. No arms, no legs. She cannot lift or hold or change the sound of rain. Shaglal, she who watches, last of the women chiefs, her unblinking gaze protects her river people forever. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you very much for reading that. So the writing of field notes to Maya Lin's Confluence Project landscapes began with the petroglyph, She Who Watches.
Yes. Because then I started talking to her as people do like me. And I did research and I kept asking her, what are you watching? And that, and this is where Google comes in. I put Columbia Hill State Park, which is where the petroglyph is now held, and it's behind fencing so people won't vandalize it. But she's looking right across the river at Nixlodix, which is the name of from her village across to the other side at Celilo Falls, a very important place in the river peoples. I don't know. It was a fishing place that has been traveled to and fished at for more than 10,000 years. And it was a great gathering place. And Lewis and Clark were there. They called it the Great Mart. And they were amazed at all the people there, all the languages being spoken, and particularly the fish, the fishing going on. And for anyone who wants to look up Celilo Falls, you can see a picture of what it looked like in 1957 before the Dalles Dam opened or closed its gate and turned it into Lake Celilo. So Coyote was right. Things are going to change. What is she going to do to help her people?
Right. Wow. Right. So anyway, so here we've got you. You are a non-Native woman learning so much.
That is for sure.
Yes, for sure. And I want to just go back really quick to Maya Lin and her her being, you know, her involvement with this and how she, you know, is so, this is so amazing because it's so environmentally sensitive. Of course, she was famous. She became famous for her award-winning 1982 Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. And yet she does all these other things also that have so much beauty to them and are so site-specific. So here she is doing that. And then you and your husband, David, go on this journey and to go to all these different sites. And that is very cool, too. It's like this bringing together of different times and different sensibilities.
Oh, that's for sure. The interesting thing is Anton Minthorn, who was one of the first elders that was on the Confluence Project board, he was a Vietnam War veteran, and he had been to her memorial in D.C., so he was deeply affected by that monument to all the men and women who lost their lives. And he got a documentary and showed it among his friends or veterans on the reservation. And they all agreed that she was brilliant in how she treated loss, as well as using the land as part of the statement. So it just kind of gives me goosebumps, you know.
Yes.
And the we in my narrative. So Dave, my husband, had just retired, and we knew that we could just hit the road whenever we wanted. And his degree was in history. And so he was always, you know, engaged in wanting to know more. So we went first to Cape Disappointment. But I do have one little add-on because David is, my book is mentions a we all the time because we traveled by car to each of the sites over the next 2 years, and they're spread out on over 438 miles of the river. So you just can't do them all in one day, nor would you want to. But I remembered that Basho, the Japanese haiku and haibun master, he also had a companion named Sora, who traveled by his side as he wrote his book, Narrow Road to a Far Province. It's actually a favorite one of mine. He's going on a pilgrimage, and along the way, he tells you how to get there, what famous places you might see, and then he feels something and he writes something, and it's about nature. And so my field notes, which were in my journal, began to shape themselves into this similar Japanese haibun style of prose filled with a traveler's narrative, place names and directions, and then small poems that reflect interior moments as well as gems of new vocabulary that were specific to that landscape. So that's why this book is really different.
It is.
It's not like anything you'll, well, I don't know. I'm happy with it because this is the book that wanted to be written. So,
and here
we are.
Okay.
There it is.
Most people are familiar with haiku, I think. You know, we certainly have heard about it. But haibun, what is that?
It's like, think of a small paragraph. Think of somebody just telling you something.
Okay.
You know, like, well, we went over this ridge and we looked out over something, something bay, and down to the valley we went, filled with flowers. And then there would be something about the flowers or something about the season. So basically it reads like I'm giving you directions how to get there. Because the myelin installations are not, they're not neon. They're not in bronze. They're very quiet. And basically when she worked with the tribes, what they wanted was to get people down to the river and see what they know and feel about the land they call home. So I could begin by reading how Dave and I had a really hard time.
Okay.
Finding please. The first ones, because that's kind of how it started. Dave and I thought, oh, this will be easy, but it wasn't. It wasn't. So each of my chapters or each of my sections begin with the day that we were there, the name of the park. So Cape Disappointment State Park, Monday, February 12th, 2018. And I tell the weather, temperature in low 50s. And I start with a haiku. Cold, cloudless morning, blinding sun reflects off waves, a Chinook blessing. Do not, as we did, begin your journey of discovery early in the week to visit Maya Lin's art installations at the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Museum. In February, even if you want to visit the museum keeps winter hours and is closed Sunday through Wednesday. As if the name Cape Disappointment was not clue enough. And just like Lewis and Clark, yes, I crave maps. Okay.
I love that. I love that beginning of the chapter because it's so fun. And it's like, yeah, Cape Disappointment is quite a name. And here
right.
you are trying to find this stuff. So actually Field Notes does help serve as a guide in, you know, how to
yeah.
actually find your way to these sites.
Exactly. And if anyone can make mistakes, I did, and David did. And what we did learn is that they were not that hard to find. We just had to ask somebody. So we left this museum, which I've yet to visit, but it's up on a high ridge overlooking the ocean. And they're now carrying this book there, which is great. So I have to go back, but
Definitely.
But the reason it's good to start with Cape Disappointment is she did four different installations at Cape Disappointment, and two of them are on one side, two are on the other side. They're both facing water, but different kinds of one's a bay, and one's actually the ocean. So, but the first place we found was the fish cleaning table, which I was really looking forward to. And we found it. And I have three, they're called Lingtaikus, about what happened as soon as I found this. It's a working fish cleaning table made out of solid basalt. And carved onto the top is the Chinook origin story. And that's one of the tribes that call that place home. So here's the three linked haiku. Fish cleaning table, carved from solid basalt, gleams as two otters swim by. Etched on the basalt is the Chinook Chehalis origin story. Read and understand how the Great River Salmon and its people are one.
That's nice. Yeah,
and then just down from there is what's called the viewing platform. And one of the group of men that went with Lewis and Clark, he has a quote that's carved into that basalt. It says, "This morning, the weather appeared to settle and clear off, but the river remained still rough. Went about 3 miles when we came to the mouth of a river where it empties into a handsome bay." And I just say, our walk, which was much shorter. Baker Bay remains handsome. Now sit down. And all these places give you benches to just sit and ponder.
That's great.
And the thing about Maya Lin, it's more than just the bench. They did a huge bunch of restoration along the shoreline. So I wrote three more haiku that kind of talk about the plants that were added. So Lynn provides a bench. Linger, listen, and learn from estuarine edges. Beneath the platform hides an unseen catch basin near wet meadow plants, common lady fern, Henderson's checkered mallow, tufted hair grass, buttercup.
So people can go explore all that if they wanted to.
Oh yeah, and if you're into native plants, you will find them there. But before this, it was just kind of bulkheads to keep the water from getting too close to the picnic tables and the parking lot. So what they did was they did a whole lot of re-landscaping it to bring it back to what was close to its regular shoreline. And it did have a wet meadow in there, which I had never heard of before. But I plucked some of these gems of new vocabulary to use into, I call them like a list haiku poem. So.
Uh-huh. That's good. I like that. And this site, this first one, is where Lewis and Clark's journey ended at the mouth of the Columbia.
Right.
And then they turned around and they went back.
They went back, but not until they stayed a winter on the coast. And there's yet another park you can go to. Where you can see it's called Fort Clatsop. They built a fort with the help of the Chinook tribe, who showed them a good place to winter over. You know, before they started down the Missouri, they wintered over in, I think it was North Dakota, at Fort Mandan. So they know better than to travel anywhere in the winter. And so that's where they stayed for quite a few months. And I heard they got really tired of eating salmon.
I don't know. It's a pretty good fish.
I guess it is until that's all you eat.
Right.
But anyway.
Morning, noon, and night.
Can I end with a really quick postscript?
Oh, sure.
From Cape Disappointment, Dave and I drove to have breakfast in Astoria, which is on our way to Vancouver Land Bridge. And we ate breakfast there, and the waitress was really cute and perky, and she said, "What have you been up to?" And I was effusive about the myelin installations. And she said, "Well, I'm amazed. I camp there every summer." In fact, she called it Camp D every summer, and she never knew about these Confluence Project art installations. And they had been there for 12 years by the time Dave and I got there.
And you end that with Maya Lin would approve.
And yes, Maya Lin would approve. She was not about bringing attention to herself at all, which is kind of wonderful.
It really is. And different, you know.
Yeah.
For anybody who's got any measure of fame or wants to have it, you know. And she does not seem to be in the business that she's in the art, to be famous. She wants to make a difference and give back.
I know. She's pretty awesome. It'd be great to meet her someday, but I don't think so. But anyway.
So Vancouver Land Bridge, what is that one all about?
I always call this one the most complicated because there were so many different cultures that found this place attractive. From the Hudson Bay Company, the fur trading company. It was also part of the Klickitat Trail, which is where the plateau tribes would come over the mountains and then come down that direction to get to the river for trading. And then once the 20th century kicked off, they had there was shipbuilding, airplane building, you name it. So basically the land bridge was the idea was Maya Lin's, but she hired a wonderful architect to build it. His name was Jean-Paul Jones. And there's Fort Vancouver, which President Grant was there at one point. Anyway, but you couldn't walk from the Fort Vancouver spot to the river anymore. There were railroads and a couple major highways on either north, south, and east and west. So they came up with a plan to build this land bridge that goes up and over all of the things in your way, like the railroad tracks, like roads, and then it ends down on the side where the river is. But you still have to walk across another parking lot, but you can actually put your toe in the water. So, and now it's used as a place to just get from point A to point B. Vancouver's doing a lot. Vancouver, Washington is doing a lot to get fun stuff going along the waterway. It's a real bicycle path too. So because of that, I think John Paul Jones said, we just wanted to throw a prairie over the river, because that used to be a prairie that the tribes used to grow camas, and they'd had controlled burns there for their first foods. And so along this land bridge, there's plantings of native plants on both sides, and they're trying their darndest to keep them watered. With climate change, it's a little harder because the rain isn't as effusive, but he built in kind of cisterns that would capture the rain. This is the architect. And then on the bridge are three different overlooks designed by Lillian Pitt, an artist from three of the river tribes. There's the land overlook, the people overlook, and the river overlook. And it's beautiful. And she's included 9 of the languages used by the river tribes as best she could to have like stencil cut words in those languages. And let's see. But I do have these linked haiku about what kind of happened all in the same place. I used to joke. I said, Dave, it's kind of like a lasagna of history. I can't believe how many layers there are. So the Klickitat Trail that once brought tribes and trappers to the river's edge to trade furs and fish and harvest camas, exchange prairie floodplains for homesteads and barracks, lumber mills, airfields, boatyards, linked by trains and roads. The Great River's beach no longer yields to cedar canoes on its banks. Mm. And then I have another 3 haiku, which are really lists of some of the wonderful plants, the native plants that are this prairie being planted alongside the land bridge. And here's the list. Wild rose and cattail, sword fern, Oregon white oak, camas and salal, cottonwood, willow, salmon and thimbleberry, western red cedar, pine maple, hazel, snowberry, ocean spray, Pacific ninebark. Hmm.
All those things planted along this
Oh, it's amazing. And they're just little, they're like little tiny samples, but I think they're going to be growing bigger and bigger. And they're just, I think now they do have to water it when it gets really, really hot, like last summer when it got over 100. But these are all native plants, so they should be able to grow there because they once flourished there. So I think it's a brilliant idea, and it's probably the easiest of Maya Lin's landscapes to drive to from Seattle. So
okay.
So when Dave and I went here, it was on our way home from Cape Disappointment.
So that was actually pretty nice. Good, you know, here you had a hard time finding the one in Cape Disappointment, and then this was easy.
You know, here's the other funny story. Because I always call myself, because I'm not a native and I'm a settler culture, and because I'm really into She Who Watches, I knew that Lillian Pitt, who's an artist that really has history with She Who Watches, I bought a brooch or a necklace that she designed from the gift store at Fort Vancouver. So I really wanted to go into the Fort Vancouver gift shop and look at some more of her art, of which I did, and I bought another piece. So we ended up doing the Vancouver Land Bridge backwards. So I started at the barracks and ended up at the welcome gate. But then I joked and said, well, I'm being welcomed to the river. So
that's right. And who's to say what, you know, what to start with anyway?
Right.
So let's go on to Oregon, the Sandy River Delta Bird Blind in Troutdale. And that's where Maya Lin created an elliptical bird blind. And it's a quiet spot where visitors can see birds and wildlife that inhabit the area today while learning about the flora and fauna that existed there 200 years ago but are now extinct, endangered, or threatened. So, wow. So you have,
I know.
This is one of the things, I mean, that's sobering, but it also makes, you know, I would think visitors appreciate what's there, you know, and to think about, you know, what, yes, what we've lost, but also to have appreciation for what's here now. You also, though, Anne, have an interesting side story that goes with this site, and I really like it. So if you don't mind telling it.
No, it's like Dave and I, we have all the time in the world, and I'm not, you know, I'm just taking my time. And this is just before COVID, which is kind of a good thing. So we were invited to a celebration at a nearby outdoor event center for the 50th anniversary of the of Jethro Tull, because Ian Anderson had been in that. He's a famous kind of pop rock flutist.
Yeah,
he was celebrating
it was the first
50 years.
Concert I went to long, long, long time ago.
Well, the funny connection is my son, who lives in Portland, he had a really dear friend, and he and his friends love to go to concerts. And his friend said, hey, why don't we do like an intergenerational concert? Why don't we all go, because it was her birthday, why don't we all go to McMenamin's Edgefield? And if our parents want to come, they'll come with us. And well, it's an outdoor place, and we can all listen to Jethro Tull. So Dave and I looked at the map, and I just started laughing. I said, this is only like 2.5 miles, this concert, from the Maya Lin Sandy River Delta. So I said, let's do it. And so I was going back and trying to remember Jethro Tull songs, and I found one that I used his lyrics, happy and I'm smiling, walk a mile to drink your water. That's from his 1969 album, Living in the Past. So I saw this overlap of going to the Maya Lin, Lewis and Clark, bird blind, singing a Jethro Tull song.
Excellent. You know, the past is here, so is the present,
yes.
So is the future, isn't it? It's all kind of
true.
Going, you know, it's all here at the same time. It's really, that is fascinating. I like that.
You know, and in each of my entries, I try to find like a little kind of quote or fact from Lewis and Clark. And so in another past, I say Lewis and Clark camped near the Sandy River Delta, and they complained they could not sleep for the noise kept by the swans, geese, white and black brant, ducks, and et cetera, on the opposite side of the river. And the sandhill cranes were really loud. They were immensely numerous, and their noise was horrid. And this was from William Clark's journal. So, but meanwhile, they're keeping track of all the birds and the fauna and the animals along the way. But I just thought it was great, because the thing about this bird blind is a lot of development happened here, including an aluminum plant, you know, that would smelt down aluminum. Mm-hmm. And then when that closed, they had to dredge out the mud and silt because it was so contaminated. And then there were all these non-native blackberries there. So there had already been a big restoration project happening there when Maya Lin was looking at it for a future site. And luckily it's on a big like park area. There's like an off-leash dog park there. And so she and her team just got together, and they figured out a trail. You walk 1.25 miles from the parking lot to the bird blind. And because we went there many years later, a lot of the native plants are starting to bring in the tree cover. And Dave was ahead of me. So I couldn't see where he was, but I heard birds first before I saw the bird blind.
Oh, wow.
So that's just to say that the bird blind and the plantings and the excavation, and they had hundreds of volunteers taking out the invasive blackberry bushes. And I can't even, I mean, it was like acres that people just came in and started, you know, hammering out.
Jeez.
So right now it's gorgeous. And there's an educator who's with the Grand Ronde Confederated Tribes, who does tours with school groups and tells the stories of the plants in the right season as you walk by them. So I got to be on a road trip with educators, and I got to hear his stories go with the plantings. Hmm. So it's kind of a much bigger version of what we saw at the land bridge, but it's pretty impressive.
That's great. So, great. So why don't we move on to Sacagawea State Park in Pasco, Washington, where Maya Lin does 7 story circles that explore the native cultures, language, flora and fauna, geology, and natural history of the site. And I thought this was really great that this site is significant because it was a well-established gathering place for Native people. And when the explorers came upon it, they knew what they were. They were for the first time since entering uncharted territory. Like that, it was already so well known.
That's right. And the interesting thing is Sacagawea is they have a museum there dedicated just to her, and it was at this spot that she met. You know, she was, they say kidnapped, but basically her. Her tribe and another tribe had some kind of war or fight, and her tribe lost. So they took a certain amount of people with them back to basically North Dakota, which is where the Mandan, Fort Mandan was. But the reason she was hired on with Lewis and Clark is because she spoke Shoshone. And so at this place where, the Snake River and the Columbia River come together, they were hoping that she could help negotiate for horses because her tribe used horses. What they didn't realize is she hadn't seen her family, the ones that lived through whatever the massacre was, in 8 years. But when she was there, she met her brother for the first time. And guess what? He was the chief.
Oh, wow.
Is that a great story or what? You know, so all along the way, the Sacagawea part of the Lewis and Clark expedition is pretty important. And so she was very happy to be there, and she was very happy to translate. There were so many languages. Like, she was married to, I remember his first name, Charbonneau, and he spoke French, and he spoke a couple of the other dialects of the tribes, but she's the one who understood Shoshone. And so I do have a really sweet poem here, Sacagawea. Because they tell you how to pronounce her name right and how not to pronounce it.
Oh,
because,
okay.
Because it means bird woman. And they say she was 12 years old when she was kidnapped by Hidatsa warriors. And they called her Sacagawea because they don't have a hard G in their language. So Sacagawea, either soft J or hard G, she comes when she's called. Sacagawea, Akaduko, Shoshone, wife of Charbonneau. She carries her infant, Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, on a cradleboard, plated lullabies in English, Hidatsu, French, with Sahaptin dreams. Sahaptin is her language.
Oh, wow.
And the story, and this is where everyone would gather. In fact, I read that it was so warm there and the winds were so constant, that would be the perfect place to dry out your salmon. And then you could store it for the winter and trade it. Or you could just store it for the winter and eat it, and it wouldn't go bad.
That's a good thing. no refrigeration or anything bad.
That's right. So, and the funny thing with this, and it's briefly alluded to in this section, is Dave and I have good friends who for about a month and a half were staying at her sister's river house on the Snake River, really close to this site. So when we visited the story circles, we gathered with friends and we talked and shared stories. So there was something very universal about this gathering place. What you have to also know is there's a dam, McNary Dam, not too far. And so really where the two confluences used to merge together, it's now a big lake. And so that part has changed. But there's one of the story circles is just a story, and it's on Coyote Circle. Notice how Coyote keeps reappearing. And here's what's written. Coyote said, "I am leaving you. I'm going back toward the sunrise, but I leave salmon for you. Every year they will come back up this river. Chinook, silver, sockeye, steelhead, bull trout." And that's from the Coyote and Lalawish, a traditional Yakima and Klickitat Indian story.
Mm, yeah. So important, you know, to the people there. Well, what do you want to say about Chief Timothy Park, 9 miles west of Clarkston, Washington, near the confluence of the Snake and Clearwater Rivers?
Well, this is, I think, one of my favorites, and it's probably because we had to drive the farthest to get there. But it means that because it's so far away from any large cities, that it's pretty... Maya Lin said that this installation probably looks the most like the same way that Lewis and Clark saw it when they came down the river. So, and this came out of Clark's journal where he said, "Worthy of remark that not one tick of timber on the river near the forks and but a few trees for a great distance up the river." And that was October 10th, 1805. And Dave and I, it took us 7 or so hours to get there because we took the long way to go through another part of the eastern part of Washington. So we gave ourselves 2 nights in a cabin at Chief Timothy Park. So that gave us lots of time to not be in a hurry. And I was very grateful. So I will read these 3 connected haiku and then I'll go a little bit more. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So think it's really empty. This is an island, Chief Timothy Park. It's a small island you can get onto by a small bridge, and it's surrounded by the Snake River. So when you get to the listening circle, insects jump and sail into the air between chirps of unseen birds. Slight breeze cools us down, low stone benches, perfect to sit, listen, heed. It's timeless message of river, land, and people. Nez Perce, that's the tribe, also called their name is Nimapu. At the listening circle, I read the words transcribed from the Nez Perce blessing ceremony. These instructions are carved into the lowest of the benches, shaped in arcs, 3 rows on one side, 3 on the other, like ripples on water. These long stone benches, half face north, half face south. And this is what's written on them. And I might just add here, it was after Maya Lin went to the blessing ceremony that she decided how to build this spot, this amphitheater. Hmm. Women sit facing north. Men sit facing south. Elders sit facing west. And no one is to walk behind them. The east is left open to greet the new day. And then after that, I write, I orient myself to the sun and find the benches that faces north, which means I sit on the south side of the circle. The Nez Perce blessing ceremony requires us to find our place among the 4 directions and to sit silent and listen to what this place has to say.
Wow. So that's what visitors are listening to, whatever the place has
whatever.
To say.
Whatever. And it's so quiet. It is so incredibly quiet. But you see, that's on the one far side of the island. If you go back to the more developed side, it's like, it's not a state park. I think the Army Corps of Engineers are leasing it to a recreation group. So you can drive an RV there, you can camp there, you can rent one of their five cabins. You can put like a rafter, a little fishing boat down a boat ramp and go into the Snake River. But forever, wherever you look, there are no trees. It's just all these different kinds of basalt formations and cliffs. It's quite beautiful. And I might say, as I'm talking about this place, the Confluence website, which I do have on my website, but anyone could just say confluenceproject.org. They've got some wonderful pictures of all these places. So you can get a visual take on the settings, which each one is so different.
That's good. Okay. So in your book, you include another place where there may be an installation or a landscape someday. And that is the aforementioned Celilo Park.
Right.
Yes. So, so you already talked about it being the center of, it was once the center of culture and commerce in the Northwest until the Celilo Falls were submerged in 1957 with the construction of the Dalles Dam and the profound destruction of the Columbia River Tribe's way of life. So this particular chapter in your book brings us back to She Who Watches.
Exactly, because this is what She Who Watches was watching. And when I was doing my research, I got so excited because I saw what the plan was by Maya Lin. And then I saw that it was on hold. And so first it wasn't going to happen right away. And then there's four tribes who have to agree, and then the four tribes agreed. And then in 2018, the Yakima Nation said, no, we're not going to do it. Our grief is so deep, we just can't imagine bringing people here to see what isn't here, or something to that effect.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And basically, this is what I got from Colin Fogarty, the director of Confluence. He says, from the beginning, Maya Lin said, we're going to take our directions and permissions from the tribes. And if the tribes say no, then the tribes say no.
Yes.
And we're just, we're not on our time. We're on basically Indian time, indigenous time. Anyway, so it's a very controversial falls. I mean, falls dam. And of course, when I moved out here, I wasn't around for Celilo Falls. I've met a couple people who were children and they saw it and they were in awe of it. I guess there was enough water that it was more than Niagara Falls that came through on a daily basis. And it was a major thoroughfare for returning salmon that go up both the Columbia and the Snake and the Clearwater to do their spawning in spring or fall, depending on the species of fish. It was awful. So, the thing in my section of this is, I mentioned I was with an educator's road trip by Confluence.
Right.
And what we did was we went to a powwow first. And this powwow called Payumsha was up at the Warm Springs Reservation. And this is where the Celilo Village tribes were relocated. If they wanted to be relocated. Some just stayed nearby near the river unofficially. So we had So we went to a celebration nowhere near a river by river people. And then we got into our van and we headed back to where we parked our cars, sort of kind of at Sandy River Delta. But it was a 2-hour trip between Warm Springs and Celilo Park. So Warm Springs is in the high desert of Oregon. And so 2 hours away down by the river is this kind of parking lot, picnic area, where you can be where Celilo Falls used to be. And I would like to just share the joy from the powwow, of which there was much, And here's some linked haiku. Regalia ready, tribes gather on grassy fields in soft moccasins, fringed deerskin dresses, otter pelts, braided in hair, fancy jingle skirts. All dance to drumming, women, men, children sing. See, we are still here. And that morning, because Linda Mienas was going to meet us down at Celilo Village, she asked if it'd be okay if she just stayed at the powwow. So she has a history because she's great-granddaughter to Chief Tommy Thompson, who was the chief at Celilo Village. But we met her at the Museum of Warm Springs, and she told her story of living in Celilo Village before and after the inundation. When she was a girl, salmon fishing was robust, and the gathering of first foods from the prairies and foothills sustained them. In fact, these were the only foods her great-grandfather ate. And here's a small haiku to him. Chief Tommy Thompson lived on salmon, roots, berries to 112.
Wow.
I know.
Longevity.
But when we arrive at Celilo Park, Celilo Falls is gone. Celilo Park is a placeholder for where Celilo Village used to be. And it's actually 11 miles east of a place called the Dalles, Oregon, also how the Dalles Dam got its name. So we say river made placid. This is another haiku. Shrouds its stone rib cage beneath backwater breathing. Silence, no sound at all. It was said that the roar of Celilo could be heard for over 2 miles. This is the place where millions of salmon flailed and jumped up cataracts to swim upstream to spawn and be caught by indigenous fishermen. This is the place where barter and trade would commence between all the tribes of the Columbia River system. This is the place of vision quests, burial grounds, protected by basaltic cliffs, etched in pictographs and petroglyphs since time immemorial. This is the place of the petroglyph, because she's both, of She Who Watches, Shaglao. She watches this place forever.
Wow. Yeah. How about that?
I know.
Yes, it's powerful. And you end the book with your own site 7, Field Notes from Home, which also serves as a powerful reflection on home. What is home? You talk about your hometown, Chagrin Falls, Ohio, and how its history is hauntingly like that of the river tribes along the Columbia River. Would you read a passage from this chapter?
Okay, let's see. Okay, the Chagrin Falls' first white settlers arrived in 1833. The cascading river flowing through lush woodlands soon changed into a manufacturing hub with multiple dams. These dams powered the sawmills that created lumber from the now cleared forests and drove the flour mills that ground the grains grown from newly created farms. In a 1 mile stretch of the Chagrin River, there were 9 mills and small factories. And by the time my mother was born in 1924, Chagrin Falls had its own school system. And by the time I attended Chagrin Falls schools, there was no acknowledgement of the first people who called this land home. There was only a vague notion that a long time ago, Indians once lived here with no details about who or why or when they left.
So easy not to know, isn't it?
And I did have some phone calls with the Chagrin Falls Historical Society man, and he was the one who told me how Chagrin Falls got its name, which I won't have to go into, but it's in my book. But they have a T-shirt that they sell there, and you want to know what it says?
What does it say?
Okay. This has to do with the dams. So the front of the T-shirt says, "Dam, dam, 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 dam. I love this town." And then on the back, so there's a map of every dam that was placed there in the early days. And they have this they had this little poem on the back of the T-shirt. Chagrin Falls, established in 1833, mill town on the Chagrin River. The river was the resource, the dams tamed it, the water wheels harnessed it, the mills used the power, the factories produced goods, the community prospered. And they have the 1 mile, and they have all 9 dams on a map and telling you when that dam was put in by year. And they were all built within a 9-year period. Huh. I didn't know that. I mean, I knew of a couple of the dams, but I didn't know about. So in a way, that's how settlers clear the land. Yes. And grind the grain. Mm-hmm. and settle in. And the thing is, that was probably actually that was all going on while Lewis and Clark were had already been coming back. But I just wanted to, as my own going back in history, recognize that we all live near rivers and creeks and lakes, and I'll bet they all have a history of Indigenous people that were here before. And
they want us to know their stories.
They do. And another nice serendipitous thing is, out here when I was looking for a sensitivity reader, Native American person,
right,
I wasn't getting much luck with the tribal members who I know are river tribal members and are poets, because by now it was COVID and they each had perfectly good reasons for not responding, and they were both very polite. But there was a woman who was from the Eastern Shawnee who was the writer in residence at the Hugo House out here, which is a literary writing center. And she's from Eastern Shawnee, which I'll tell you, they were in Ohio. So I told her about my project, and she, because she was the resident poet there, she agreed to look at my manuscript and give feedback. And a perfect example of a sensitivity reader is, this is a line that she helped me change one word on. It says that the Cascading River flowing through lush woodlands, I originally said the Cascading River flowing through virgin woodlands. And she said, Anne, I would change the word virgin. There were people there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's what I mean. It's
that
just like
great.
So.
Great edit.
I just wanted to end on that note. So
that's excellent. Well, your website is annhersey.com, and that's where people can find your book.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. Well, it's a charming read, and as I said at the beginning of this show, it's really beautifully designed. You did a great job.
Oh, that I give full credit to our book designer, Dan D. Schaefer, and he worked with me all during COVID. We were I called the book Salmonberry Press because he helped me find a publishing house in Canada. But we worked on how to put it together and what it might look like, and he's brilliant. He is brilliant. So and can I also add, there are blank spaces between each of the sections. So if you're out here visiting any of these sites, you can add your own field notes.
You know, I meant to ask you about that. It even has a place for the date up in the top.
For the date, and there's cute little emojis for the weather that you can circle, uh-huh. And for the temperature. That was something that Dan
excellent.
And I thought about. So, but for those of you who don't live near the Columbia or Snake River, just find any river and just pencil in your own responses. There's a company called Field Notes, and they have this quote, Field Notes, I'm not writing it down to remember it later. I'm writing it down to remember it now.
Oh,
I know.
I love that. Yes.
So there's a real immediacy of this is what I experienced on this day at this time in this season in this weather. And And I've now visited all the sites a second time with a friend of mine, except the one farthest away, because it is such a commitment of driving time. You really need to stay overnight somewhere.
Right. Yeah. Right. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing your poetry, your prose, and your stories. This has been terrific, Anne. I really appreciate having you on.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. And it's www.annehersey.com. And be glad to share my book with anyone who wants it. And it has a PayPal, Venmo way of purchasing it.
Okay. And I will have a link in the show's description, too.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks again. This is Kate Jones with the Gale Hill Radio Hour. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Please remember to subscribe, like, and share. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you.